bottom of this hand. A blessing to me, the blessings return in all that I see. Pale riders out over the hill, shadows upon us, and they follow us. We'll go out our lives and feel the love. This love is free. I'm dreaming of me. We'll make it our home. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Epic Radio here. As soon as Railroad Earth gets off the stage, there we go. It takes a bit to get those boys off the stage. Welcome to the... I've got a little too strong a signal there, don't I? Welcome to... let's see. Why are we getting that strength? There we go. That's more... More like it. Let me turn my headset up a little bit, I guess. Okay. Check. That looks good. Welcome to the Paris on the Potomac Show, part of the old Winners and Losers radio program here on broadcasting now on Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. My name is John Case, and... Well, it's been kind of a rocky road here on the Epic Radio station. But, I mean, what other kind of road is there these days? I keep thinking of different ways to do things, and most of them involve more work than I want to do. That's my problem. Anyway, today we got a great little lineup coming up here, though. We got... Paris on the Potomac. I think we're going to get a call in from, let me see if I get their names right. I hope we're going to get a call in. Poor Gail Becker, you know, our great friend and, you know, I keep seeing red lights on my thing here, and I don't want to see red lights. I want to see something less than red lights, because red lights mean I get distortion. There we go. Okay. Maybe a little better now. Gail Becker, our co-host here, and for several years, well, a lot of years now, has been gotten a bad flu and has been under the weather now for 2 weeks in a row. Even though he keeps making gigs here for the show, which we are delighted about. Anyway, I think a woman named Katrina Brown, a producer director of documentary films, and Zuni. Matena. Is that right? Yeah. I should look at that on a little bit. Hey, John, look at it on something that you can see. You know, this is the old age. Yeah. Katrina Brown, a producer, director, and Zuni. I think it's Zuni. It might be Zuni. There's no E. Hard to pronounce sometimes. You know, formal names. Matena, discuss the film Faces of the Trade, understanding international, intentional, I wonder if she means intentional or institutional, racism, unconscious biases, and white privilege that today impact New England as well as the Deep South. Interesting. Okay. And this is apparently has a, the film has a URL. www.tracesofthetrade.org basically the film's title spelled out without any spaces. tracesofthetrade.org. Anyway, at 9 o'clock, Labor Beat's going to be coming up here, and J.B. Christensen is going to back from his first trip to the legislature. Being interested to hear his impressions of that, and as they get started on a well, for the Republicans, who dominate the whole thing, except for the governor, Jim Justice, who's coming out in interesting ways. I'm not going to make any fundamental statements. He's making very strong statements about education. I hope that means something in the way of action. He's talking about raises for the teachers, which they desperately need. Anyway, we'll see how that goes. Of course, the Republicans act like the budget problem, which now looks like about a $500 to $600 million shortfall. They're incapable of, and I think most likely incompetent, you know, to deal with it. So, we'll see what happens, you know. We'll get firsthand information here this morning. Also, I think we're going to have a call in from a delegate from Charleston, Misha Poor, and also a former congressional candidate. She was here when she was running for Congress, so I don't know, 2 years ago. And just we had a great time talking to her, and she's a great, just a great organizer and a great people's candidate. African-American woman from Charleston, West Virginia, and very effective in the legislature, or she was. This new legislature, we're going to find out what effective means now. might mean something different. Okay, so with that, let me get started here. I'm going to play, I'll put up a little tune here this morning from my, you know, short box. I don't know what that means. and we'll, because I have a, you know, well, I know what I want. I want a different version of, yeah, well, I got this one. Right. So let's try this one. Is that right? Let's see. Yeah, here we go. When the night comes falling. Morning, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Katrina Brown.
Hi, Katrina. I was playing a little bit of Jeff Healey there, and I almost didn't hear you ring. I mean, I apologize for that. But my name is John Case, and Katrina. So you are a filmmaker. Am I right about that?
Yes.
And you. So let me hold on. Gail Becker, who's been contacting me, was very ill. You know. And he sent me some emails. I got copied on the emails, but I was expecting him to be here this morning. But he's the flu's got him down. And you know us old timers, we sometimes have a hard time with the flu. You know, so.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
But anyway, thank you so much for calling in. I'm very interested to hear about the film that you're making, and I understand that it's what's the title again?
Traces of the Trade: A Story from the Deep North.
Of the Deep North. Okay, and which trade are we talking about?
The slave trade.
And how far back does this So tell me about the film.
Yeah. It's a finished film that came out in 2008, and it basically chronicles my discovery that my ancestors were the largest slave trading family in U.S. history. So they were basically the worst of the worst. And
these are your ancestors, huh? Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I have some ancestors that were not much better, so we can share that.
Yeah.
What part of New England are we talking about?
Rhode Island. And Rhode Island, as is not commonly taught in history, American history classes in high school and college, Rhode Island was the state that dominated the slave trade, so it sent more ships to West Africa than any other state.
And did the slaves actually come into Rhode Island and then get transported where, mostly? South? Or,
no. What they happened? Weren't brought directly to Rhode Island. The ships originated in Rhode Island. So it was Rhode Island ship owners and captains, and they would sail with products for trade, such as predominantly rum.
Yeah.
As well as other things, but rum was the main currency. So they would sell the rum to West Africa, trade for Africans, and then bring people for sale at auction to the Caribbean, to the South, you know, Charleston.
Charleston, yeah, or one of the, yeah, right. One of the slave markets, yes, right.
Yeah, and then they would bring sugar, you know, typically they would bring sugar or molasses up from the South or the islands
What are we talking about? We're talking about here prior to the Civil War, right? And up to and including the Civil War?
I mean, there was a federal ban on the slave trade on the international slave trade that was outlawed in 1808.
That's right.
Talking prior to 1808, although there was a pretty big illegal trade continuing after 1808 out of Cuba. The dominant period was for my ancestors, for example, was 1769 until 1808, but then they continued illegally probably until at least 1820, if not longer.
Right. And then I understand that actually one of the economic impacts was the slave trade became a cash trade, like you would breed slaves and then sell them internally and transport them west, right? Or that was part of the...
After the international slave trade was outlawed, then the domestic slave trade begins, which is predominantly, you know, like Richmond was a hub for that.
In some ways worse, right? I mean, because the breeding aspect became just horrendous.
About. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about the film, the process of were you trained as a filmmaker before you did this film, or was this your education?
No, it wasn't. My brother went to film school, not me. I didn't have the training, but I had a background in startups and in of nonprofits and in work in kind of multicultural nonprofits and social change. And I learned this about my family history from my grandmother in my late 20s, and I just felt like it was such an important story to tell, because not just, you know, if we had been a Southern family, I probably wouldn't have undertaken it, but the fact that it was this very history.
Yeah, right. So it's
Northern complicity.
Right, and which is forgotten sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and that amnesia, like the amnesia in my family kind of mirrored the amnesia of the North as a whole. So it felt worthy of the subject, and I decided to not learn the skills to make the film myself, but to raise money to hire other people. So
right, sure, yeah. Well, that's what you, yeah. Start with what you know.
Yeah.
Hey, so now the process of the film, it's documentary. Am I correct with this? So it's, but it, is your family explicitly mentioned in it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a first person documentary. So the structure of it is that I decided it was too big and too intense and too important of a subject to handle by myself. So the structure was that I wrote to about 200 DeWolf descendants. That was the family name, DeWolf.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote to 200 descendants, most of whom I didn't know, but my great uncle had addresses of people kind of hidden.
Wow, you had somebody around who keeping track. That's good. Yeah, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote to people, and of 200 people, I heard back from about, well, let's see. I heard back from about 50 of the 50 mm-hmm. or 60. 16 expressed interest in my invitation to come on a journey to retrace the triangle trade.
Wow.
And of the 16, upon further conversation, 9 people signed up. So basically 10 of us went and retraced the triangle trade from Rhode Island.
I can't help but ask you, you know, has this introduced some difficult Thanksgiving dinners in your family?
Yeah. Well, one of the greatest compliments I got was actually the film premiered at Sundance in 2008,
mm-hmm.
and one of the Sundance staff members said, because you know you hear that you get into Sundance right before Thanksgiving, and he said, I'm already, just the people who reviewed your film, you've already impacted all of our Thanksgiving dinners.
Yes, I'll bet. I'll bet, because, yeah. Well, now, is that part of the intent? Have people maybe look back into their own history a little more than...
Absolutely.
You know?
And there are, not surprisingly, many, 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 many Northerners who didn't realize that they had slave trading or more commonly slave owning in their family tree. So, you know, all the blame gets put on the South, but in truth, mm-hmm. more people per capita in the North owned enslaved people. They just typically owned one or two or three people in their, you know, to work on their farms or blacksmith shop or carpentry shop.
Right.
So they owned fewer people, but more people owned other people than in the South, where it was...
Well, in addition to enslaved peoples, there was also indentured, right? I mean, that I'm sure there was a racial distinction there, but or maybe I assume there was.
The conditions were very different. So indentured servitude was, more typical Europeans, and it didn't involve the... Absolute, as you can appreciate, the stripping away of culture and religion and family and freedom, right. And everything was just much more horrendous.
You know, we have we have a storyteller that does a show here on Mondays named Fanny Crawford. I don't know whether you know her or not, but she's from Hagerstown. But she, her family background it's interesting, I think, has both. She has African-American background in history, but also about every other race in the country. she's a real symbol of a, like, I guess she's the first one that wants to put mixed down on what race are you in the on your application for it. But she told me that that there was a background of slave owning as well as not large numbers, but I mean as well as slaves in her background, family background. But that her, the owner of her, I guess, great grandfather. I'm thinking, I can't remember what was great or great great. But anyway, because he owned the slave, but he freed him. But he says you have to get out of here and go farther north. Now this was like right before the war, I believe, and because. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't tell what's going to happen here. There's very active groups. So, you know, people come and kill you or whatever. So even though I think in Maryland at the time it was kind of iffy, you could be freed, but it was so controversial, especially in Western Maryland, that he said, okay, you're free because I'm going to die and I can't afford to work you guys anymore. So take off and but Mike, get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
Well, or they won't be honored, you know.
It's an interesting dynamic because of this, you know, the sort of broad brushstrokes way in which we learn American history in school without a lot of depth and nuance and with whole chapters left out.
Yeah.
The concept of going north to be free, that sort of implants itself as I think it leads many of us white folks in particular to think like, the North must have been heaven for Black people.
No,
quite the contrary. So right. the racism. I remember when I first started working on this film, you know, in the early years of doing the research and reading scholarly books and whatnot, it was like this double take where I was like, "Oh, just because the North abolished slavery sooner than the South doesn't mean there wasn't slavery here for 200 years, and right. just because we abolished slavery in the North when we did doesn't mean we weren't still racist up North, kind of through and through."
Yeah.
So there was, yes, sort of legally, structurally, there was more freedom after a certain point, which was pretty late, in the North. You even had slavery still in New Jersey up to the 1850s, for example.
Well, you could be designated a fugitive slave, though.
Yeah.
I can't remember what year I guess it was Massachusetts first that decided not to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. And that was fairly late. I don't even remember exactly when that is. That was within 20 years of the war.
Yeah.
It was fairly late, but nonetheless, yeah. After that, you know, that if you did escape enslavement, and then you know there was you might not be returned. Okay, if you could get to Canada, for example.
Right.
Yeah, I think by North, I think sometimes they meant Canada, right? So.
Right.
Yeah, well, this film has been out for a while. So, what was the status at Sundance? You guys got some recognition, or what happened there?
Yeah, we premiered there in what they call in competition or in the documentary category, and we didn't win any awards, but. Getting into Sundance itself is a
huge
award, so I wasn't complaining. And we got picked up as a result by PBS. So we were the film was aired nationally on the series called POV.
Right. Great hit. That's a wonderful win.
Yeah.
Okay. So what reaction did it? You must have gotten quite a bit of feedback at this point. And what's been the feedback?
The film. You know, it's intended to cover this buried history, but it's also showing, as you can guess, you know, if you follow 10 white descendants with 10 different personalities and generations, we span the spectrum from 30s to 70s between the 10 of us. And so following us, grappling with this history, with the history and with the legacy. So basically, you know, we met with scholars in Rhode Island and in Ghana and in Cuba, but we also met with people of African descent, Ghanaians, Cubans, American, African Americans, and got into some pretty heated discussion about what does this mean? And, you know, more commonly, the question of what is the legacy of slavery for Black Americans is a more common question. The question of what is the legacy of slavery for white Americans is a less common question. And that was basically the key question we were asking ourselves. And we were both coming at it from the perspective of being descendants of this extreme case of, you know, kind of the worst history possible. But we also, you know, walk around the world as a lot of us didn't know this prior to my grandmother's booklet and the discovery that I made digging further into it. So we weren't walking around experiencing life per se as descendants, but rather as white Americans. And we had a range amongst us of people who had a fair degree of kind of wealth and class privilege and folks who didn't. So we kind of spanned the spectrum with regard to that. So, you know, we were grappling with things that when all was said and done, people watching the movie, there's sort of the spectrum of white folks who feel like I don't relate to you guys at all. You're this elite family, to people who yeah. absolutely do relate, and people who realize that, you know, class difference is very real and very important to talk about, and there's still a sort of universality to white skin privilege that was really important for us to reckon with, and that I know audience members, you know, end up feeling like they have to look in the mirror as well and take on some of that.
You know, the sense of relative privilege that can operate very complicated ways politically, depending on whether the difference is what direction things are going in. You know, for example, I remember during the '60s that where the term '60s and '70s, where the term white privilege was you know, well, it was pretty common debating thing among at least on the left anyway. It was as you tried to, you know, find ways in which interracial or multiracial organizations and unity within an organization could be established, and what were the, you know, the kind of rules for doing that, which was, you know, a lot of people weren't that familiar with, you know, how are we going to come together as at least political equals, you know, and work together. So that would, you know, so new rules about, you know, what constituted the whole question of white privilege became a very big one there. But on the other, but in the '60s, you remember, incomes were going up.
Yeah.
And in a sense, they'd been going up since after the World War II, all right, for median families, okay, except for African-American families.
Right.
And one of the things that happened in the '60s was that, you know, part of this mass impetus behind the civil rights movement, especially some of the later stuff that Dr. King was doing with the Memphis sanitation workers, was, hey, what about us? You know, you know, everybody's doing better, but we're not. OK. And how about, you know, the whole thing? But now you have a little bit, you know, now since 1973 to now, there's been almost zero. Actually, the median family hasn't gotten a raise worth spit in 40 years, to be truthful. They haven't. But see, and actually a lot of, you know, formerly so-called middle class, you know, took a slide as manufacturing declined and all these other things going on. And so now you still have a relative difference. There is a white privilege even today, but now you're in an environment where, you know, the median person is either flat or going downhill.
Right.
And it's interesting how the politics of it, you know, change considerably. You know, how sensitive I am to your claim of discrimination when I'm doing a little bit better, and yeah, you should get some too, as opposed to I'm going down the toilet, and yeah, I know you're worse off than me, but you know what? You know that there's a sense of a different dynamic now, and so I'm interested in how people respond to the term of white privilege now.
Yeah.
As opposed to some years ago.
You're raising an incredibly important, highly relevant to current politics subject. And one of the tragedies, and I'm not, you know, this has been said.
Yeah, right, sure.
One of the tragedies of American history is that white working class and African Americans haven't made as much common cause as they might, you know, arguably have reason to make.
Right.
And in realizing how, in pushing against, you know, forces that undercut the ability of people to move into the middle class and stay in the middle class.
Yeah.
So, you know, job loss in the manufacturing sector to automation, you know, even in the election and post-election, people refer to the issue is being a case of losing jobs to overseas, but there isn't as much discussion of losing jobs to automation.
That's true.
It's
huge.
How you know, people are becoming increasingly unnecessary to the production of goods.
Yeah.
Well,
especially to production. Now, services, I mean, you know, there's probably an infinite supply of services that one can get involved in, but it's very difficult to get people paid for it unless it's a very, you know, I mean, you know, that's a very difficult problem.
And so to me, it's a, major tragedy that that you know, white folks who are struggling turn their resentment towards, be it African Americans or immigrants, as opposed to towards those who are kind of controlling the economic system. You know, we can, there are lots of shorthands, Wall Street, for example, but
yeah.
know, even that can get overly simplistic. But it, you know, sort of how to, this, seeing the backlash against the Black Lives Matter movement.
Right.
When people are like
being murdered,
and black communities have been, you know, are finally saying enough. And I think the vocabulary, so part of the goal of the film and what we're able to do with it is show the film and then lead discussions and help people kind of break things down in a more nuanced way than just talking about racism as if that one word kind of sufficiently
yeah.
or adequately captures the dynamics.
When are you going to confess your racism kind of conversations?
Right. Instead of saying, like, there's something called unconscious racial bias, where you can be consciously not wanting to be racist and identify as a, you know, non-prejudiced person who's, you know, call it colorblind or call it not racist.
Sure.
But you might find that you do actually have very unconscious biases based on how we're all raised with certain
sure.
images and stereotypes and whatnot. So things like the police, you know, we get into these very inflamed ways of pitting, you know, black people versus mm-hmm. black communities and particularly young black men versus the police. And
right.
as opposed to saying, like, look, the police do have unconscious bias. Like, we all have unconscious bias. How do we help deconstruct that unconscious bias and shift it in such a way where there can be more honesty about how it does play out? And it's very deep-seated type of problems that we don't need to be yelling at each other and blaming each other, in my opinion, but rather like finding constructive ways to really understand how we got here, which is based on a, you know, horrendous history.
Mm-hmm.
And white people need to show up more to kind of, in good faith, look at what the vestiges of those history are that we still carry, be it unconscious bias or be it some privilege that, you know, it's hard to feel when, like you said, when you're struggling economically.
Let me ask you about this. This is another, I'm sure, controversial issue. A lot of times in African-American community organizations, and not only African, I hear this actually from sort of lefty kind of things sometimes. Reparations for slavery, the history of segregation. I hear different, you know, claims. And what do you think? What do you think about that approach to what's the value of the demand for reparations? Does it have is that the right demand, or whether or not it's achievable at some particular point, is that an important demand to raise?
Yeah, so that we do get into that in the film, because it would have been a case of avoidance if we had not gotten into it
right.
as a family, debating that on camera, and we end up talking to Professor Charles Ogletree at Harvard Law School and Professor Glenn Lowry, who I think was at Boston University at the time, who are pro and con reparations, respectively.
Right.
And, you know, Glenn Lowry, for example, says, whatever the rightness, I can almost quote him directly, whatever the rightness of these claims in principle, as a matter of politics, you know, it seems like it could work against us. So he takes a pragmatic approach of saying, it'll create more enemies than allies if we make those claims, whereas Professor Ogletree
right.
argues that it's the right thing to pursue, and so we should pursue it and we should make our case. And my own opinion is that the concept that there is a debt to African Americans, that this country owes a debt to African Americans, I feel sort of unequivocally we do. We have we have a debt. The travesty of this institution and that the harm that it unleashed is epic, and mm-hmm. we have not made up for it nearly to the extent that you know, if someone were to come here from Mars and,
right.
you know, hear about the institution of slavery, how long it lasted, how, you know, de facto and de jure segregation lasted another 100 years.
Right.
And, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They'd be like, and what did you do to make up for this, you earthlings, you know?
Right. Right. But the politics has to, I mean, the politics plays out.
Part.
Yeah, I mean, the politics plays out well most beautifully in Dr. King's elucidation of the problem of freedom. although I don't think he ever, I don't ever hear, remember him making a speech on reparations. Maybe he did. I'm not quite sure, but
he talked about a check. He talked about a check that hasn't been able to be cashed.
Right.
The check that bounced, I think.
The check. Oh, yes, that's true. Which was based on
insufficient funds.
Reconstruction was right. Funds. Yeah. Yeah. Did use those metaphors, but that's very, very interesting. And I find that's it's one of those discussions actually you have because you know a broader discussion of real ongoing equality. What would, you know, what's the society that offers equal opportunity to every citizen?
Yeah.
And if you could get there, then maybe maybe the debt burden would not feel so heavy.
And that's part of Glenn Lowry's argument is let's focus on programs that benefit the poor of all backgrounds. And that would include African Americans. I think I would just add to that there is something unique about the harm that was done. And so I don't think strategies to improve conditions, education, healthcare, housing, et cetera, for the poor, I don't think they should necessarily be totally colorblind. They should have a wisdom and an intelligence about the needs of different communities. And in a lot of ways, it's also about white folks kind of, I think if we, in our hearts, and I know this is a big ask, like you said, at a time when people are feeling so vulnerable, but if in our hearts we've sort of found our way, I think there's just so much resistance to empathizing on the part, you know, white folks empathizing with
right.
black folks and saying, like, if this had been my history, how would I feel today? What degree of anger would I likely carry? How would it affect my trust of white people? You know, if you empathize, you suddenly realize, like, yeah, we've been completely untrustworthy for most of American history. And then we get all defensive today. Like, why do they still have an issue? Why are they still playing victim?
Right.
You
know, well, I think.
And I think unpacking right. some of those attitudes and getting to a more human connection that creates greater empathy, then creates a greater sense of debt. Then you can get to the public policy questions once it's grounded
yeah.
in
real life.
Dare I say, like a spirit of love your neighbor and so on.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation. We're going over our little time limit here for a minute, but I want to try one more little thing, because for example, it occurs to me that there's a vital role that could be played here. By faith communities, and I the reason I'm raising that is because I see how important. Matter of fact, I don't know that any of these recent Republican, ever since Reagan, I don't see how they would ever have won any election without this very energized religious base. Over a number of wedge issues, you know, that somehow became the moral center of this base, okay? And, you know, but there is also, people are going to be, with the loss of public services, especially here in West Virginia, there's another $500 million budget deficit coming up this time, and there's no question who's going to take the bite on that, okay?
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have to be helping take care of each other.
Yeah.
And I think if we could find ways, you know, to model, you know, multiracial things where, you know, hey, you know, Bertolt Brecht once had a great line. It says, are you starving? Only hungry men can feed you.
Huh.
I said, are you starving? You know, it was one of his anthems to the soldier, to the in the war against fascism, right? You know, that starving, hungry man, are you starving? Do you want to feed you? Only hungry man can feed you.
I missed who you said.
Bertolt Brecht.
Oh, okay.
You know, the German poet, playwright, Mack the Knife, et cetera. You know, but he was a very consistent anti-fascist. I think he was a communist for a while. I don't know whether he stayed one, but he was for a while. And he wrote these great, you know, poems. But that sense that, you know, rather than I'm going down the toilet and why should I support any affirmative action or anti-racist stuff for all you other guys, you know, what about me? Instead, you know, looking toward these folks as your brothers and sisters and turning the thing around.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree completely. And churches are, should be candidates for bringing people together. And you know, there are more liberal denominations and more conservative denominations and churches. And so some of the splits that, you know, are in our country show up on the faith side as well. But I still remain kind of incurably optimistic that churches or communities of faith
can be
the place that you bridge some of that.
I hope so. Well, anyway, it's been wonderful talking to you, and I want to see the film
now.
I really do. Can you see it online now, or is it? Are they going to have a showing around here, or what's the deal?
We had a showing just recently, which is where I met Gail at Shepherdstown Presbyterian Church, and we do a lot of screenings through churches by request. So if folks are interested, the website is tracesofthetrade.org.
Right.
And we sell the DVD of the film online. It's not actually streaming online yet. One of these days I'm going to set that up.
But, right.
In the meantime, we sell DVDs and we take requests and invitations to come screen. And we do that at schools, churches, museums.
Wow.
Community groups, et cetera. So we'd be happy to come around. I live in Washington, D.C., so it's pretty close.
How long is the film?
It's an hour and a half, or there's an abridged version that's an hour.
I was thinking about, you know, see, I work with the Quakers here in Shepherdstown.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I one of the reasons I work with the Quakers actually is because years ago I was a union rep in Vermont, and I had a very good friend named Crystal Holzer, who was kind of the leader of the Quakers. If they, you know, Quakers don't like to recognize leaders so much, but she was a spiritual leader, okay, of the Quakers in Vermont, and the mother of the nuclear freeze campaign up there that went on for several years.
Uh-huh.
But the reason I once asked her, I said, "How did you become a Quaker?" She says, "Well, you know, it was complicated because my father was a Lutheran minister in Germany prior to World War II." And I said, "Well, what happened?" And he says, "He was assassinated by the Nazi brown shirts for speaking out against Hitler." And I said, "So then what?" He says, "Well, the Quakers made it possible for me and my brother to escape. The rest of my family was slaughtered."
Wow.
And so I became a Quaker, obviously, you know. So, and anyway, I learned a lot about it from her. So now, we have dinner parties. We have a thing called Friendly Eights. You ever heard of them? Where we you invite eight people, you know, four couples, whatever, for dinner, and you have a little, you know, and for some purpose, right? Like other than just eating, like for example,
uh-huh.
seeing this film.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking that maybe it would be a nice little Quaker project to have little dinner parties and have maybe the abridged version. You know, if you have a movie for an hour and a half, it can work into the dinner menu a little bit. But an hour, that could work.
Great.
That could work.
That sounds great.
So I'm thinking through that. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome.
Okay. By the way, I have recorded all this. I'll put it up on the podcast, and I'll send you a link to it. Okay?
Sounds good.
All right. Take care. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye. All right. So, that was great. That was Katrina Brown, a filmmaker, and made the film Traces of the Trade, of Slave Trade, a biography, a documentary centering a little bit on her own family's biography. And very, very interesting. Well, we're going to take a little break here. You're listening to Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And we're going to take a short break and do a little music here. And we'll be right back. And welcome back to the Paris on the Potomac show here on Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, above the Four Seasons Bookstore, right in the middle of West German Street here in Shepherdstown. And Paris on the Potomac, that's what we call it here, our little jewel. And we're picturing ourselves between the world wars. Having an enlightened conversation until the bombs start falling and the tanks start marching in. Then we have to leave the cafe for a while. But I'm going to play next here a recording of Jerry Brown, Governor of California. I think this is his address to the... I believe this is his address to the state legislature in... although it might be the one to the American Geophysical Society. That's a pretty serious defiance of the newly elected President Trump. And, well, it comes close to a declaration of secession. It's not that, but it's a step on that road. And very, very serious, probably the most serious actual opposition to Trump. You hear a lot of, but there's a lot of opposition. But the governor, the state of California, and perhaps even the entire West Coast, which is so dependent upon technology, or has become so, that and technology companies that I think, well, and they aren't in the inner loop with Trump. So I think, you know, well, they'll either make an accommodation with each other here soon, or it's going to be an all-out split, which hard to predict what that would lead to. Anyway, this is Jerry Brown, and it's an important voice now, even though he's 80 years old. He's about, he's refound his youth a little bit, and so I want to give that one a chance here. Here you go, Jerry Brown. Hopefully.
Good morning. We ask our guests and visitors in the rear of the chamber and in the gallery to please stand for the prayer. The day's prayer will be offered by our assembly chaplain, Reverend Bob Oshta. Reverend Oshta?
This is the California State Assembly that he's going to be addressing here. This whole tape is going to take about 30 minutes.
Today, the California State Assembly and Senate for the State of the State Address by our Governor Edmund G. Brown Jr. Let us close our eyes in a moment of reflection. The past, the present, the future. We can yearn for the past and wish for how things were before, but we cannot live there. We cannot live in the past. We can wonder and worry about the future, but we cannot live there. We are only living in this moment right now. From the past we can learn, for experience is the seed of wisdom. For the future we can plan, aware that what we do or do not do will be a part of creating what is to come. Knowing this, let us try our best to have what we do now be guided by wisdom of our experience and motivation that is so deep and so genuine, it is worthy of being called compassion.
Obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully.
He's swearing in the new Attorney General now.
Discharge the duties upon which I'm about to enter.
Discharge the duties upon which I'm about to enter.
That's it. Thank you. I'm not sure what that reference to the calendar was. I don't have a calendar. Although I know the days are drawing near. Anyway, thank you very much. Thank you for all that energy and the enthusiasm. It's just what we need for the battle ahead. So keep it up and don't falter. This is California. We're the sixth most powerful economy in the world. One out of every eight Americans lives right here. And 27%, almost 11 million, were born in a foreign land. When California does well, America does well. And when California hurts, America hurts. And when we defend California, we defend America. As the English poet John Donne said almost 400 years ago, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And therefore, never send to know whom the bell tolls. It tells for thee. A few moments ago, I swore into office our new Attorney General. Like so many others, he's the son of immigrants who saw California as a place where, through their own grit and determination, they could realize their dreams. And they're not alone. Millions of Californians have come from Mexico and 100 other countries. And they've come here making our state what it is today, vibrant, even turbulent, and a beacon of hope to the rest of the world. We don't have a Statue of Liberty with its inscription, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." But we do have the Golden Gate and a spirit of adventure and openness that is welcome since the gold rush of 1848, one wave of immigration after another. For myself, I feel very privileged to stand before you this morning as your governor, as my father did 60 years ago. His mother, Ida, my grandmother, the youngest of eight children, was born in very modest circumstances, not very far from where we're gathered today. Her father arrived in California, right here in Sacramento, in 1852, having left from the port of Hamburg aboard a ship named Perseverance. I just learned that last year. Perseverance. It's that spirit and perseverance and courage which built our state from the beginning. And it's that spirit which will get us through the great uncertainty and the difficulties ahead. It's customary on an occasion like this to lay out a specific agenda for the year ahead. Six times before on this rostrum, I've done exactly that with enormous detail. And as I read through those State of the State speeches, I was really amazed at how much all of us have done together. We've increased by tens of billions of dollars the support for our public schools and universities. We provided health insurance to over 5 million Californians. We've raised the minimum wage. We've reduced prison overcrowding, and most important, we've reformed the system of crime and punishment. And that's really significant. We've made California a world leader in the fight against climate change. We passed the water bond. We built up a rainy day fund, and we closed a $27 billion deficit. And during the last 7 years, California has reduced the unemployment rate from 12.1 to 5.2%. By the way, I said California created that, not us. We helped a little bit, I hope, and hopefully didn't cause too much interference. Anyway, 2.5 million jobs, almost 2.5 million jobs have been created, and that's not all. But this morning, it's hard for me to keep my thoughts just on California. The recent election and inauguration of a new president has shown deep divisions across America. While no one knows what the new leaders will actually do, there are signs that are disturbing. We've seen the bold assertion of alternative facts, whatever those are. We've heard the blatant attacks on science, familiar signposts of our democracy, truth, civility, working together, have been obscured or even swept aside. But on Saturday, we also saw something else. In cities across the country, we witnessed a vast and inspiring fervor that is stirring in the land. Democracy doesn't come from the top. It starts at the bottom, and it spreads in the hearts of the people. And the hearts of Americans, our core principles, are as strong as ever. So as we reflect on the state of our state, we should do so in the much broader context of our country and the challenges it faces. We must prepare for very uncertain times and reaffirm the basic principles that have made California the great exception that it is. First, in California, immigrants are an integral part of who we are and what we become. They've helped create the wealth and the dynamism of this state from the very beginning. I recognize that under the Constitution, federal law is supreme and that Washington determines immigration policy. But as a state, we can and we have played an important role. California has enacted several protective measures for the undocumented, the Trust Act, the driver's licenses, basic employment rights, and non-discriminatory access to higher education. This is what made the Dreamers, and you made it happen. We may be called to defend those laws, and defend them we will. And let me be clear, we will defend everybody, every man, woman, and child who's come here for a better life and has contributed to the well-being of our state. My second point relates to health care. More than any other state, California has embraced the Affordable Care Act, and over 5 million people now enjoys its benefits. But that coverage has come with tens of billions of dollars from the federal government. Were any of that to be taken away, our state budget would be directly affected, possibly even devastated. That's why I intend to join with other governors and senators and with you to do everything we can to protect the health care of our people. And by the way, we're going to fight for Planned Parenthood, who have been unfairly attacked in too many places in this country. Our state is known the world over for actions we've taken to encourage renewable energy and combat climate change. Whatever they do in Washington, they can't change the facts. And these are the facts. The climate is changing. The temperatures are rising, and so are the oceans. Natural habitats everywhere are under stress. The world knows this. 194 countries have signed the Paris Agreement to control greenhouse gases. Our own voluntary agreement to accomplish the same goal, the Under 2 MOU, has 165 signatories representing a billion people throughout the whole world. We can't fall back and give in to the climate deniers. The science is clear. The danger is real. We can do much on our own, and we can join with others, other states and provinces, even countries, to stop the dangerous rise in climate pollution. And make no mistake, we're going to do exactly that. Fourth is infrastructure. Now, here's the topic where the President of the State has firm intention to build and build big. And in fact, he met with several labor leaders yesesterday and committed to a $1 trillion investment in public works across America. And I say, amen to that, man. Amen to that, brother. We're there with you. The President said in his inaugural address, we'll build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. And in this, we can all work together, here in Sacramento and also in Washington as well. We have roads, we have tunnels, we have railroads, and even a dam that the President can help us with. We should get some applause there, shouldn't we, Jim? And that's what's going to create good-paying American jobs. As we face the hard journey ahead, we have to summon, as Abraham Lincoln said, the better angels of our nature. Above all, we have to live in the truth. We all have our opinions, but for democracy to work, we have to trust each other. We have to strive to understand the facts and state them clearly as we argue our points of view. As Hugo Grotius said, the famous Dutch jurist very long ago, even God cannot cause 2 times 2 not to be 4. When the science is clear and when our own eyes tell us that the seats in this chamber are filled and the sun is shining, we must say so, not construct some alternative universe of non-facts that we find more pleasing. Along with truth, we must practice civility. Although we've disagreed often along party lines, we've generally been civil to one another and avoided the rancor of Washington. I urge you to go even further and look for new ways to work beyond party and act as Californians first. Democrats are in the majority, but Republicans represent real Californians too. And by the way, those Californians want to be heard too, and they want to be listened to. So let's work together as Republicans and Democrats and find more things to do together. We went beyond party when we reformed workers' compensation, when we created the Rainy Day Fund, and we passed the water fund. Let's do it again and set an example for the rest of the country, and in the process, we'll earn the respect of the people of California. That's a very good sign of potential bipartisanship. That may have been the biggest applause we got. So that's together, not separate. And then there's perseverance. It's not an accident that the sailing ship that brought my great-grandfather to America was named Perseverance. That is exactly what it took to endure the dangerous and uncertain months at sea, sailing from Germany to America. While we now face different challenges, make no mistake, the future is uncertain and dangers abound. Whether it's the threat to our budget or to undocumented Californians or to our efforts to combat climate change or even More global threats, such as a financial meltdown, or a nuclear incident, or a terrorist attack, this is a time which calls for courage and for perseverance, and I promise you both. But let us remember as well that after the perilous voyage, those who made it to America found boundless opportunity, and so will we. Let me end in the immortal words of Woody Guthrie. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. And here's the part I really like. Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking that freedom highway. Nobody living can ever make me turn back. This land was made for you and me.